Accession number 8736, rule number 48.
Lord Harding, tape 48. Was there any difference between the national servicemen and the regulars regarding the performance in Cyprus?
No, not really, I think. No, I used to spend a lot of time, of course, going round visiting the troops and the police and talking to them. I never came across what I call the reluctant national servicemen. They thought they were, or anyone that thought he was really wasting his time. They knew there was a job to be done there, and they knew it was a difficult one, and they put their minds to it and their hearts into it. So I don't think so.
Would they have been involved in the same operations as regulars?
Oh yes. I mean, every unit was composed. I don't know what percentage was, but a majority wise of national servicemen with a regular army nucleus. Oh no, there was no difference, no distinction between them at all. No, they were all one regiment.
When you changed over in Government House, your domestic staff, from the Cypriots to the army, would these have been national servicemen?
Well, it might have been. I don't know. I think the chap who came in, the sort of head chap who ran the catering, must have been a regular soldier. But the waiters cook helpers almost certainly national servicemen. The same applied to the guard, the guards on Government House, and also to the escort. I had an escort of ferrets from the House of Cavalry, which I used whenever I went by road anywhere. And they were, I should think, mostly national servicemen. But you don't distinguish between them. There's no difference. They're soldiers. They're British soldiers. They serve in the British Army, and they're proud of being in their various regiments. But they were. I don't remember coming across anybody who resented having to do his service. They thought it was a bore, perhaps, and unfortunate, but they realized that it was necessary.
How did it work in Government House, having servicemen as your
domestic? Very well. I mean, they adapted themselves. We had, at that time, Lord Duro, who was the Duke of Wellington's son. The then Duke of Wellington's son was commanding the Blues and Royals. Blues they were then, and he had a corporal of horse who ran his affairs and his mess and so on, and he brought him in to run the staff at Government House, and he was an excellent. He now works for the present Duke of Wellington at Stanfield there and looks after the staff there. It works out all right. They were very, very good.
Did they cook good food for
you? Oh, yes. Yes, they were very good. I mean, the head chap was I don't know what his rank was, maybe. I don't know whether he was a warrant officer or a senior sergeant in the Army Catering Corps. And he was very good. Oh, no, they were perfectly all right. My wife was so satisfied with their services.
How about cleaners? Were they responsible for cleaning the place as well?
Well, they did their domestic duties, yes, yes.
So the case would have been you had no Cypriots at all?
No Greeks or Turks, no, whatever.
Yes,
no,
it was
an entirely British staff.
And that was after the bomb attempt?
That was after the bomb in the bed, yes. Oh, no, they're very good. They're the British soldier is a very adaptable individual. Look at my corporal now. I can't remember precisely when it was, but
yes.
the Grievous declared a truce. Well, a truce is a two-sided thing, and so what he meant was he stopped operations. On the first occasion, I was very doubtful about whether they it was very serious or not, but we thought that it was a good opportunity to call for an extension of the ceasefire and a handing in of arms by Yoko, but there was no response to that, and then it only lasted, I think, 2 or 3 weeks. And then they resumed operations, and then I think it was the year, next year, following year, they did declare again what they called a truce. And that is when I came to the conclusion that they had suffered. And we had inflicted a severe defeat upon them. They weren't destroyed. They had a recovery potential, and which, as I told you, I estimated to be about 6 months. And that was a period in which we hoped that the negotiations on the international and the individual level would proceed and avoid any re-outbreak of violence. And nothing did occur during the rest of my time. And that's why I decided that the time had come for me to be relieved. I'd completed my 2 years, I'd done what I set out to do, and I asked the government to relieve me of my job and to replace me, and I thought the time had come for them to replace me by what I call a political animal.
Yes, I'll ask you about that a little later, if you would bear with me, Lord Harding. In March 1956, during your period in Cyprus, Glob Pasha was sacked from the Jordanian army, wasn't he?
That's right.
Did this have any repercussions in Cyprus?
Well, yes, it did. It was really not just Glob's dismissal by Hussein. It was the abrogation of the Anglo-Jordanian Treaty. And this had a definite bearing on the importance of Cyprus from the British strategic point of view. Because, as I explained earlier on, the conception of the British Chiefs of Staff was that Cyprus would be not only the headquarters, Middle East headquarters, but also a staging post for reinforcements of troops or forces used to support Hussein in fulfillment of the obligations under the Anglo-Jordanian Treaty or as membership in their membership of the Baghdad Pact. And the fact that the Anglo-Jordanian Treaty was abrogated unilaterally by Hussein meant that there was no possibility whatever of using Cyprus as a staging post and thereafter for the movement and the deployment of large-scale land forces in northern Iraq, because they would have had to go through Jordan, through Israel and through Jordan. And so this changed, in my view, the strategic importance from the British point of view of Cyprus. And I came to the conclusion that because of these changes, there was no possibility of our requiring the use of the whole of the island of Cyprus for operations in support of the Baghdad Pact or of Jordan. And that meant that any military action that we took in support of the Jordan Baghdad Pact would be confined to air action and airborne operations on a very limited scale. And that meant that there was no question of deploying large-scale land forces in the Middle East through Cyprus. And so my conclusion from that was that what we needed for the future then was not just Cyprus as a base, but bases in Cyprus. And this was an entirely new concept. And this was accepted by the London government. And it eventually, of course, led to the fulfillment of an agreement about independence of Cyprus, provided that we had bases in Cyprus. And this was the concept which eventually led to the creation or the existence of the two sovereign-based areas, Akrotiri and Decatur, where there was a British air base and a small British garrison, which was capable of being air-transported to in support of the Baghdad Pact. And this made a very big change in the British strategic requirements for Cyprus, and eventually was, I think, a main factor in enabling Macmillan to reach agreement about the independence of Cyprus, provided that these two sovereign-based areas were provided for us, and that is the existing situation.
Could I now ask you about Suez in 1956 and how this affected the situation in Cyprus? First of all, what did you yourself think of Nasser's action regarding the nationalisation of the Suez Canal?
Well, I went, when I was CIDS, I went with Eden to attend the first meeting of the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. And on the way there, we stopped off in Cairo, where we had a meeting with Nasser and his Foreign Secretary Fauzer and the commander of his the Egyptian Armed Forces, Field Marshal, I can't remember his name now. And we had a meeting in the British Embassy. There was a dinner party to start with, which rather was, they had women there, and that was no use. But after dinner, Eden and his advisors and I met with Nasser and Fauzi and this Egyptian army commander and discussed the situation. And our plan was to try and persuade the Egyptians, Nasser in particular, of course, that it was in their interest, as well as in the interest of the region, that they should join with us in the what was then called the Baghdad Pact. And I was put on, the plan was that I was put on to bowl to start with and to explain to Nasser the British Chiefs of Staff's concept of the way things should develop. And I explained that our view was that the indigenous countries, that is Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Iran, and Pakistan, should provide the elements of a defensive organization in the forward troops and resources and so on, tactical air forces. And that we and the Americans would provide the logistic backing and the strategic air power which was needed to make the thing effective. And for that purpose, of course, Egypt was a linchpin, a key feature, because it had the dual access through the Mediterranean and the Red Sea, and also had the industrial capacity which was needed and the necessary air fields and resources which had been developed during the war. And I explained this thinking. And at the end, after that, Eden asked Vanessa, would you like to comment? And he said, oh, well, I agree entirely. And so Eden said, all right, well, if you agree with that as a concept, surely you must agree that it's in the interest of your country to join with us in this. And he said, no, but this is for a solid hour, and this is just indirect imperialism and control over Egypt. And I wouldn't be able to carry my own countrymen with me in this respect. And so that was that. And on the way, we flew on from Cairo. We stopped off in Karachi for discussions with the British High Commissioner there. About the Pakistan view of the future of the Baghdad Pact. And on the way, I thought, well, why the hell did Nasser agree with my outline concept of what the Baghdad Pact should develop into, and Egypt's participation in it? And I came to the conclusion that what I described by way of a concept of a defensive organization covering the area between the Caucasus and the Himalayas was something that Nasser would like to bring about under his own leadership. And that, I think, was the origin of the eventual seizure and closure of the Suez Canal by Nasser. And the antagonism and the suspicion that arose in Eden's mind about Nasser's reliability and intentions. And that, I think, eventually led to the Suez operation. But I had been in Cairo, in command of a machine gun battalion, at the time of what is known as the Zaghloul riots, which were for the independence of Egypt. And looking back on that experience, I had formed the opinion that if you wanted to maintain the use of the Suez Canal, you had to be in Cairo yourself, or else have someone in Cairo who would conform to your views and interests. And so I was quite sure that as long as Nasser remained in control in Cairo and had the support, the general support of the Egyptian people, that the reoccupation of the Suez Canal would not achieve the purpose. And therefore, I thought the Suez operation was mistaken and a big blunder, both from a political and a strategic point of view. And I think the only thing that could have been done would have been immediately that, or very quickly after Nasser took control of the Suez Canal, would have been to have landed a military expedition and marched on Cairo and occupied Cairo, but that would have involved a very large force for an indefinite period. And certainly the British government had the resources to do that. And that was primarily the reason why I had not raised any objections to the move of the British Middle East headquarters from Cairo, from the Canal Zone, to Cyprus. Or the change of the Canal Zone base onto into civilian control. Not that I had any confidence that that would have been effective in a war. And that was that. And so I look upon the Suez operation as a very major a mistake.
You mentioned earlier on in the interview when you were travelling around with Eden in 1955, that he seemed a very sick man. Do you think his illness had any bearing on this decision about suicide?
Oh, yes, I think definitely. I don't know that I was right in saying that he seemed a sick man in 55. I think he was all right then, but later on I think his health began to deteriorate and that affected his judgment. I remember coming home from Cyprus once to report to him and going and seeing him when he was on a sickbed in number 10. And certainly he wasn't a fit man at the time of the serious, when the decision had to be taken about serious. But to what extent that affected his judgment, I wouldn't know, but I think it probably affected his judgment adversely. In any case, in my view, I think the Kiesestas were wrong in not setting their faces deliberately against the operation that's planned to resume control of the Suez Canal in cooperation with the French and the Israelis. I think that was a tactical and a political and a strategic mistake. And I was very surprise when whatever his name is who commanded the landing at Cyprus came to my office in landing at Suez came to my office and told me that the operation was on and was to be preceded by a 7-day or 5-day or 6-day air bombardment. It didn't seem to me to make much sense. Anyway, I was worried about it, and from the point of view of my operations, my anti-terrorist operations in Cyprus, it was extremely damaging because it meant the removal from active operations against the Ochre of the Parachute Brigade and the Royal Marine Commando Brigade. And that was a very, very serious loss, and it set back our operations indefinitely, until they returned and resumed the availability for anti-terrorist operations. Oh, it was set me back by whatever it was, 6-8 months or more.
That was because of the increase in outrages, because of the troop depletion, was it?
Well, it was the fact that we are the anti-terrorist forces available for operations against the Ochre were very substantially reduced. I mean, the Parachute Brigade and the Royal Marine Commando Brigade were the leading elements in the operations against the terrorists, against the Ochre. So you take them away and you're left with very little.
Did that mean you had to impose sterner measures to cope with that, Gav?
No, I don't think it's any sterner measures, but it very much restricted our operations. I don't think the measures were changed, but the availability of security forces to enforce the or carry through the measures was very much reduced. Very much reduced.
And when the troops returned from Suez, was there an immediate benefit felt?
Well, I think so, yes. I find it difficult to cast my mind back to that particular time. Yes, of course, it made all the difference in the world.
Do you think, with your wide experience looking at the Suez affair, and particularly the American role, you know, the fact that the Americans withdrew their support from the British and we withdrew from Suez, do you think there were any lessons from that affair? Did we learn, perhaps, that we couldn't act without the Americans?
Well, I think probably that was the main lesson. I think probably that any attempt to deal with a problem of worldwide significance and importance without the wholehearted support and interest of the United States of America was a mistake. And this meant that I think that Eden thought at the time that he had the agreement and interest and support of Eisenhower, but that, of course, was a mistake. If he thought that, he was mistaken. And in any case, the Foreign Office appreciation that if we reoccupied the Suez Canal zone, there would be a political revolution in Cairo, and a government would come to power in Cairo that was favorable to our interests and views, was a very bad appreciation and was completely mistaken, as long as Nasser was in Cairo and in control there. Any idea of a political revolution was out of the question.
Reading through Eden's memoirs, he seems to have equated Nasser with Hitler, doesn't he? You know, do you think he was a man of similar nature to Hitler? You know, your impression of Nasser, what did you think of him?
Well, I don't know about that. He was, I think... my impression of Nasser from the meeting we had with him in Cairo on our way to the Far East was that he was a strong character and a dedicated nationalist, that he was determined to maintain his own position in command and control in Egypt, and that he firmly believed that that was in the best interest of his countrymen. I think that was his position. What he was comparing with Hitler, I don't know. No, I think he was a very strong, determined nationalist who thought that by opposing any suggestion that he and his government should enter the Baghdad Pact was furthering what he thought, he believed to be, I think he was wrong, what he believed to be in the national interest, the Egyptian national interest. I think that was the thing.